In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome back to another episode of the How I Quit Alcohol podcast. For first-time listeners, please be aware that not all of the conversations within this podcast are suitable for children. I'd also like to add a trigger warning that sometimes the conversations can get a little heavy. We may talk about things like sexual abuse, domestic violence, drug use, and alcohol use. And if you feel that that may trigger you, please do not tune in. Also, I'd like to add, if you are a heavy daily drinker, please seek the help of a medical practitioner before quitting alcohol. This podcast comes to you from beautiful Bundjalung country. Please kick back and enjoy, grab yourself your favorite alcohol-free bevy, and if you haven't already, do a gal a favor, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Hi, and welcome back to How I Quit Alcohol. Today in the Zoom room, I'm so excited about this next guest. Her name is Julia Lawrenson. She's one of the How I Quit Alcohol grads from way back now. It seems like quite a while ago now. And she's just an amazing human. She is an author. She's a presenter. She's a public speaker and a dog lover. She's also been sober for well over a year now. And I'll get her to tell you the specifics shortly. But Julia Lawrenson, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. How are you?
I'm very well, Danny. And thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
I'm so excited because I've wanted you to come on for so long, and I'm sort of always like, come on. And you're like, in time, it'll happen in time. So thank you so much for coming on. So I've just finished your amazing book called How to Avoid a Happy Life. I was lucky enough to get an advanced copy, which I felt very, very special, and very special that I got a little mention there at the end. And but that's not why I'm plugging it. So here we are today. That book is due out the 30th.
I know. It's hard to believe that it's actually coming into the world. It's pretty freaky.
Oh, my God. So 30th of April, people can go ahead, if they're listening today, can go ahead and pre-order the book, or they can, at the time of listening, they might go and buy it. We'll put links to everything in the show notes, but people are probably going, what is this book about? And it was just about your amazing, incredible life. And my God, what a journey. I was reading that most nights and just going, oh my God, like so much has happened. So without giving it all away, can you tell us a little bit about, let's just say about your history, and your history with alcohol is a good place for us to start for this podcast, Julia.
Sure. So as the title of the memoir suggests, How to Avoid a Happy Life is about the odd things that have happened to me in my life. And some of those things have happened because of the things that I've chosen, and some of the things that have are things that have just happened to me, and it's just a bit of a mixture of the two. And I think in the background, I'm probably not that explicit about it in the memoir, but alcohol is in the background throughout all of it. So I come from a family of drinkers going back generations. And I started drinking from a fairly early age. And right from the get-go, I had a problematic relationship with it. And I was aware of it. Even when I first got drunk, I think when I was 14. And right from then, I already knew that it was a problem, that I wasn't drinking for good reasons, that I was drinking because I wanted to escape stuff.
Mm-hmm. And even though the memoir is not about alcohol per se, still absolutely fascinating. And so many things where I'm just reading going, no, just so much. There were so many tragic things and then so many moments of absolute, like, just beautiful moments as well. But talk to me a little about, if you don't mind, about your mum's relationship with alcohol, which you do touch on in the book, and how that might have affected you.
So I remember my mum drinking before my parents split up when I was 9, but mostly it was social. She was kind of contained or constrained, I guess, by being married. I do remember her getting blind drunk a couple of times, but they were one-off situations. They were kind of, I found them puzzling and upsetting, but it wasn't a huge theme, I guess, in my life. After my mother left my father when I was 9 years old, her drinking escalated, and the behaviours that went along with that also escalated. So to go back to my mother's background, so my mum, her father was a policeman, and he was really, really strict with the whole family, but in particular he was very strict with her. And when I say strict, I mean, you know, in those days it was nothing for kids to cop a beating for speaking back or doing whatever, but even by the standards of the day, my grandfather was over the top with my mother. So she was the middle child. She was very lively. I think she probably had ADHD, and it was very hard, like she never sat still. She was very bright and musical, and she just copped it more than her older sister and younger brother did. So she grew up being terrified of her father. And in fact, he beat her so hard when she was 16 that she sustained some kind of brain injury. So she was passing out for about a year after that. And she always after that had a tremors in her hands. And wow. So she grew up feeling very conflicted because she loved her father, but she also was terrified of him and never stopped wanting his approval, I think. So she got pregnant out of wedlock when she was 18. She was actually, when she sat my grandparents down to tell them, my grandfather gave her a belting and then told her to get out of the house. She went to Melbourne. She caught a train to Melbourne as soon as she could, and she got a job working as a housekeeper until her baby was due to be born. And so she had to give her baby up for adoption. And she never wanted to do that, but there was no single parent benefit in those days. So it was a really difficult experience for her. And so she had to move back to Western Australia. She had to move back in with her parents, who had kicked her out because she was pregnant. And because of that, she married the first man who came along, who happened to be my father. And she was very upfront with me when I was a kid that she only married my father to get away from her own father. So when she separated from my dad, it was her first time of feeling freedom. And she expressed that freedom through just drinking a lot, partying, having all these different men in the house. And it was, we went from having quite a stable life. I could tell that mum and dad were unhappy, or that mum was unhappy, but it was a kind of a stable unhappiness. And then it just went to unpredictable chaos, I would say, for the next probably 6 or 7 years. So from the time I was 9 till when I moved out of home when I was 16, it was a constant cycle of her getting smashed either in social situations, so at parties, or if she'd split up with a boyfriend, she'd be angry drinking, and then she'd take off in a car driving drunk, and I'd be at home terrified, wondering whether she was going to come back. So I was aware that alcohol use was a problem for her. Having said that, while she was also doing that and being chaotic, she went back to school. She did year 11 and 12. She got top grade. She went and became an accountant of all things, mainly because her father said that she'd never do it, I think. So she managed to achieve at the same time that she was having this incredibly chaotic life of, you know, with all these different boyfriends, and we moved around a lot. We moved in and out of different boyfriends' houses, or they moved in with us. So for me, it was a very destabilizing experience. I loved my mum, but I felt I wasn't the priority in her life. She did say to me that she loved me, and I believed her, but the way that she behaved didn't really kind of fit with, I guess, with that. So, yeah, I guess it was no surprise then that when it was actually my mother's friends who got me drunk for the first time when I was 14. And it was, yeah, and I remember that first time. It wasn't the first time I drank, but it was the first time I got drunk. And I went, oh, now I understand why they do it. It makes you like an infant, makes you like a kid. You don't think about anything. You don't care about anything. And it was, yeah, it was a moment of revelation for me.
Okay, I've got a few questions here. So firstly, thinking about mum drinking that much when she finally had the freedom to do so, do you feel like also thinking about the violence that she endured in her own childhood and also the fact that she had given a baby up for adoption, do you feel like there were things that had never been dealt with before? Like, had she sought professional help to deal with those things?
Oh, God, no. That was, I mean, I'm not sure that there was any, but it just wasn't what happened at the time. What's interesting for me is that she was quite conscious, particularly about the effect that the violence had on her. She knew that it had messed her up. And I think she was also conscious of this long-standing grief over losing my brother. It was just something that she could never quite resolve. She was conscious of it, but it didn't give her any tools to deal with it. But I guess at least she knew. It wasn't like she didn't want to talk about it. She used to talk about those things with me quite a lot. I became her carer, I guess, that's the way that I felt when I was, particularly when I was a teenager. I felt it was my job to take care of her emotionally, to make sure that she wasn't upset and she was hungover. I'd make toast for her or whatever. You know, it was, I guess I found the role of being needed gave me an identity.
Whoa, wow. Yeah, that's pretty full on, isn't it? And we've talked about it before on the podcast when parentification happens, where the child becomes the carer emotionally for the parent or other siblings because the parent's not able to do so. And it's a burden that child has to carry. Like, it's too much for a child, for a young person to have to do that. But that's what we do, or some people have needed to do to create safety in their worlds.
Yeah. And for me also, because I was very introverted, as a child, like I was really, really shy when I was a kid. And I don't know, if I'd been a different personality, I did enjoy some of the partying, I have to say. Like, I used to join in. I used to love dancing and staying up late and having salt and vinegar chips for dinner. But by and large, I would have been better served, I think, by having a calmer environment, because it was a real stretch for me not to have a safety. And I did seek it out in other ways, like books were my security. So I might be moving house every 6 months, but I had my favorite books to go back to, and I made my own safety in those ways.
Well, in a way, you created escape.
Yeah. Yes, I did. Yes.
And often that's how escape when we were younger sometimes, and we find it in different ways. Then when we're older, that escape often then becomes alcohol. Lo and
yes.
Behold. Yeah. Now, yeah. That unpredictable chaos that you spoke about too, it's really hard when you have a parent as well that's chaotic, but you also felt loved by them.
Yes.
And I can also attest to that. Yeah. And there's then this sense of incongruency, like, well, no, hang on. And I can't complain about it either, like when we're older, because I was loved, but yet there was so much chaos and unpredictability, and that makes you feel so unsafe as a kid. And it's so... Oh, it's just, I guess it just puts you at odds with yourself. It's like, well, one minute I feel safe and secure and loved, and then there's this other side that where it's just absolute chaos. I don't feel important. I don't feel cared for, all the rest of it.
Absolutely.
No wonder also where you said that when you drank, it makes you feel like an infant. I thought, wow, and I wonder when you were an infant, perhaps there was times where you did feel cared for and safe. You said there was more structure there when you were a child before mum and dad broke up. Do you see that link also, perhaps just as a subconscious thing?
I think so. It's really interesting because my mum wrote me a letter when I was pregnant with my daughter, and she said that I was okay until I was when okay in terms of I wasn't terribly anxious until she had a series of miscarriages starting, I think, from when I was 2 or 3. And so she was suddenly rushed off to hospital, and she said it was then that I became really anxious when I was a child. Now, I don't remember that. I just remember being anxious. They're my earliest memories are of being anxious and frightened, and I didn't associate them with any particular thing, but I guess that makes sense that she did that. But then when my daughter was born, she said to me, think, because with my daughter, I did all the attachment parenting. She was breastfed until she was 3. Like, I wanted to do everything differently. And my mum, I remember saying to me, oh, you're creating a rod for your own back. When you were a baby, I used to just feed you and then put you in a room and let you cry. You know, which was, I was like, oh. So
now it makes sense.
I didn't feel the desperate sense of feeling abandoned, I guess, until after my parents split up. So, yes, I do think I have some core memory of being cared for somewhere in there. And I think that's probably the reason I have managed to cope in some way or another, and that I haven't completely gone off the rails. I think I had some core of feeling loved and feeling cared for, even if it wasn't in a total way, when I was very young. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Julia, where you said that you felt that separation, there was obviously that separation anxiety, the chaos that was created. There was that probably a reminder of the separation that you felt when mum was taken off to hospital. There was separation anxiety then when you didn't have mum suddenly because she's gone to hospital. But yet then also I'm thinking about that infant baby that was fed and then put in a room and left to cry. What do you think goes on for a baby in that moment? Like, I know it's, you can't remember it, but if you were to imagine a baby just put into a room and left to cry.
I just think that's horrific. Like, because that would make that baby, I think, feel like they're not valued, that they're not cared for, that they don't have people around who will soothe them. And I know people have different views on controlled crying or whatever it was, but I was always that was one thing I was like never, ever, ever going to do to my daughter. Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. I had quite a few fuck-ups as a parent, but that wasn't one of them. I wanted her to know in her bones that she was loved and cared for and that people would take care of her.
Absolutely. But it's interesting too when we can trace back kind of, like, I don't know about you now as an adult, but do you ever feel separation anxiety as an adult or a feeling of rejection?
Absolutely. Well, this is actually one of the things that happened when my mother died, and I wasn't expecting this at all. I felt absolutely abandoned when she died. It was this really primal feeling. And I mean, I was aware that we'd had a problematic relationship and I tried to work on some stuff, but this came out of nowhere. That's what it felt like for me. It was just this absolute upswelling of grief and abandonment. And I realized too that I had that with my husband as well when he started going through what he went through, and I had it with my partner when he had his mental breakdown. So it's kind of been a theme. And actually that's been the thing that sobriety has allowed me to really dig into and work through and face up to, is that feeling of abandonment and the ability to start trying to reparent myself.
And I think by the sounds of it, this reparenting needs to go back to that infant baby.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And yep. So for people listening, they might think, what the fuck are these two on about? Well, do one of my courses and you'll find out. But yeah, it is really important to see those links and to understand, well, where did the core of this come from? Where did this core fear in me come from? And look at this. We trace it all the way back to this baby that was left to cry it out. Now, people might go, well, fucking hell, Danny, like, what are you going to do about that? Well, here's an opportunity that when this sort of feeling comes up where we feel the fear, we feel the anxiety of that separation, rejection, anything else that might kind of go hand in hand with separation anxiety and what we might make that mean about ourselves. Okay, I feel it in my body. Mm-hmm. What does my body need? What does that part of me need? What would a little baby have needed back then? And if I say to you, Julia, what would a little infant baby need? Well, firstly, what would a little infant baby be experiencing when they're left to cry in a room on their own?
I guess it just feelings of being alone in the world.
Yeah.
And that I think that's what I think. Yeah. Yeah. Fear just being alone and uncared for.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, people, I know that little babies aren't actually thinking that, but this is to do with sort of deeper, more implicit memory stuff. And so, what would an adult you do to a little baby or do for a little baby if you needed to go back in time and soothe a baby that was feeling scared, vulnerable, afraid, not cared for?
Yeah. Well, I would just go and pick her up and cuddle her and tell her I loved her and keep carrying her until she feels calm and soothed.
Yes. And so this is the beautiful, when we do the work and we can kind of start to identify these things, where it's not becoming a victim of our past, but going, oh, that might be what I need in this moment, rather than going smashing myself with alcohol or scrolling or Netflixing or whatever it is that you might do to soothe, but actually maybe I need to just hold myself. So it might be just rocking side to side, or maybe a weighted blanket, or however it looks for you. It might be just curling up in bed. And for me, it's always rocking side to side, maybe hand on chest, hand on belly, even a pat like that until the nervous system comes back into some kind of calmer state. So, yes. So that was probably good learning for people listening. And they might be also freaking out going, what the hell was that? But okay, so we went pretty deep there, Julia, not where I was imagining this conversation to go, but you never know what's going to happen on these chats. Okay. And so the other thing that stood out for me, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, when I read the book, when I went through that journey with you in the book of those relationships that you made with girlfriends, with friends, especially that one in particular that you were so desperate to kind of have her approval and you sort of followed her around like a puppy dog by the sounds of it.
Yeah,
I can't help, especially in this conversation when we've just uncovered what we've uncovered, just that feeling of not being valued and seeking approval and that kind of thing. Do you see that link as well between that girl that sort of felt that need for validation and approval and then carrying that on into relationships as you got older?
Oh, absolutely. It's been, this is actually one of the things I'm really working a lot on at the moment, is my need to achieve and prove myself. So that's something that has driven me through my life. And I am learning, and, you know, I'm 54 years old now, so it's still, the learning is still happening, learning how to accept myself for who I am now without having to do anything or prove anything, just because I'm alive, because I'm a human being who deserves love just for existing. And it's been absolutely profound for me to try and come to a point of loving myself and accepting myself just for me, not because I'm doing one thing or another thing or I've achieved this or I achieved that, just because it's what all humans deserve. And that is a real for me, it's readdressing the seeking of approval of others or wanting, choosing really people who are incapable of loving me as the people who I follow after, determined that I'm going to make them love me. You know, it's been a recurring theme for me. And so I'm doing the work now just to learn to sit with myself, with who I am, without anything else, without needing to be anything else. And I don't know if that, it probably doesn't sound like much, but for me, that's absolutely huge. It's a game changer for me.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, it does, it sounds like a lot. I think we all have that. I suffer from that myself, the constant kind of pressure we place upon ourselves. And at some point it's like, when does the study stop? Or when does, you know, like this constant seeking to get better and better and better. And I've identified that in myself recently, where it's like, what would it be like just to stop and just be me and just be, you know? And it's a pretty scary concept sometimes for some of us. For what you've achieved in your life, speaking of achievements, from going from kind of couch surfing, I would, you know, I'm reading the book thinking, this lady's homeless. Like I would say, like pretty much homelessness, to all that couch surfing, to bouncing from one place to the next and really not looking like you had any prospects.
Yep.
To going on and studying law and getting a PhD and working in parliament, and you're just like, it's phenomenal what you did achieve. I mean, to look back on your life and to go back and write the book that you've just written, your memoir, to just get it all down on paper like that, what's that feel like? How does that feel to finish that book and look at it all as a whole like that?
It's been massive. I first started writing the memoir to try and make sense of all those feelings that came up after my mother died. That was my first impulse, was just, I just needed to make some shape out of it, because it just, everything felt chaotic. I just felt like my life was a huge jumbled mess where things had just kind of randomly happened to me, and I could not make sense of it. And so that was initially the project, I guess, of starting to write it. And it was actually really helpful. The process of writing it was really helpful. So I actually hired a mentor to help me write it, because I didn't feel I could do it by myself. Not because I couldn't do the writing part, but because I didn't know how to write a memoir. I didn't know how to approach it. So I worked with an American writer called Howard Norman, and he was just incredibly helpful to me, and helpful in, he was like my fan club, and we really had a deep bond during the time that we were working together. But he would just ask me, he was kind of like a psychotherapist as well. So he would say, you know, you're skimming over this bit. So, for example, there was one section where, at the beginning of a chapter, where I write about the extension that we had on the house, where my bedroom was in between my husband's and my daughter, and that I'd done that to make space between them. And he said, you're going to have to explain that. And I was like, oh God, do I have to? So I had to go back and unpack all of that, which was incredibly difficult. But in the process of doing it, he said, what is it that you learnt about growing up in the chaos of your childhood that made you able to deal with that? What were the things that you carried over through your adulthood that made you able to cope with things that were really difficult? At the same time, that they were sometimes the things that put me into situations that were really difficult, because I was just acting on my own unconscious desire to replay painful things over and over again. So writing the book gave me a perspective on my life that I hadn't had before, and it was very, very hard to write. As you can probably tell from reading it, it is warts and all. So I had to be brutally honest with myself about the things that I didn't do very well in that process. There were times where I wasn't a very nice person. I was absolutely not a victim throughout all of it. There were times where I have behaved abominably and shamefully, and I had to reckon with all of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was absolutely part of the writing process.
I think part of everyone's healing journey should be writing their memoir, you know, with someone to actually sit there and go, now, hang on a minute, you're skimming over this bit, or why, you know, it's such a great, although I haven't written a memoir, Ash and I have written a book recently, but also we've been working on it for years, actually. But even if I just sit and write my timeline, like sometimes I'll just sit there and write key moments in my life, and even just doing those things and or going through times where I've acted like a dick and writing about that.
Yep.
I mean, there's so much healing in it, but I tell you what, maybe we're onto something, Julia. Maybe there needs to be a 2-month retreat where we go and write our memoirs and just need to have a few therapists handy, I'm sure. But yes, okay. Now, so to go back to the alcohol, sorry, because we've kind of done a sideways step there. So tell me, for you, when the alcohol really started to kind of step up, were you starting to feel like this is becoming a bit of an issue for me?
Look, from the time I started drinking when I was 14, so I started off really as a binge drinker. And I would just do so much stupid shit when I was pissed. Like, I mean, everybody does, right? It just seems to go with the territory. But it started becoming a problem for me, I guess, in two times. One was I was in a comedy group and we were performing. And, of course, as an introvert, I mean, I love performing, but performing all the time or often, it really drained my reserves. And of course, when you're in comedy clubs, we often got paid in booze. So it became a way of coping with the feeling of exposure, I guess, that I had from performing a lot. And it started becoming a habit then. And then I got pregnant. And so when I got pregnant, I had to leave the comedy group. And the person who I got pregnant to was my ex-girlfriend's brother.
I love that deep dive into the book.
Oh, my God. And who was fine when we weren't living together. Actually, he probably wasn't fine when we weren't living together, but I was able to have separation from him. But when I moved in with him, it became evident very quickly that he was incredibly controlling, that he couldn't cope with the stresses of family life. I became incredibly ill and I felt like I was trapped in that situation. So that was when I started drinking to cope, and that was when it became a problem. I would say that started from before my daughter was one. And then because of some of the medication I had to go on when she was three, I actually had to stop drinking for a couple of years. And it's really interesting looking back on that, because I just had to stop, and so I did, but I was white knuckling it. There was no point at which I didn't feel better for not drinking. I think I was a lot healthier, but I never stopped wanting to drink. And so when somebody who was on the same medication as I was on said to me, "Hey, guess what? You can drink a bit. I know they tell you not to, but you can." I was like, "Fuck yeah, I'm in. And so I started drinking. It started off being in a controlled way, but the more chaotic my home life got, because my husband got more and more controlling and started becoming really controlling and aggressive towards our daughter from when she was about 3 years old. And I coped with it by drinking when I got home from work. So I was the breadwinner. So I was going out to work and coming home. And I used to dread coming home to him, because as soon as I walked in the door, there'd be a drama between him and my daughter. They'd both come to me going, "Meh." And I'd be like, "Hang on, I need to get a glass of wine and then I'll listen to both of you." And so it kind of started from there. It became really problematic around when I started working at Parliament, because we had a bar in my workplace. So there was access to alcohol and drinking was really accepted. So my work life became, you know, revolved around alcohol to some degree. And also my husband was starting to act really, really strangely. So those two things in tandem just led me to become a daily drinker. And it just escalated from there. So it's not a spoiler alert, I don't think, to say that my husband was eventually diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's at the age of, so he was 52 when he was diagnosed. So I was 41, I think, at that stage. And the behaviours that went along with that, with him having early onset Alzheimer's, to me felt like an extension of the controllingness and abusiveness that he'd had towards me and my daughter before he was diagnosed, like long before he was diagnosed. It just amped it up. And then all of a sudden I was in a position where I couldn't escape. Not that I felt like I could have escaped before, but then I just became conscious, I guess, that his behaviour towards me was abusive and that I needed to get away. And right when I had that realisation, he was diagnosed and I was like, right, I'm stuck with this now. And it was, I knew that I was using alcohol to cope. I told everybody that that was what was happening. I saw a counsellor who said to me, you know, if you keep on drinking, you're going to end up with an alcohol problem. And I was like, have you got any other suggestions? And she didn't really. And I was like, right, well, alcohol is here. It's reliable. Sometimes it felt like the only thing that got me through the day was knowing that I would have a drink at the end of it. Yeah, so that was, there were probably 5 years like that, I think. Yeah, no, 5, 6 years, maybe longer. Yeah.
Sorry, yeah. It's also no wonder too. Like when you don't have any other tools, and when your counsellor's not giving you any other tools, like you, it sounds like you did reach out and say, well, have you got any other suggestions? Nah. Well, what are you going to do? Like that's so, like I can't even imagine how stressful that is. Even what you were talking about earlier before he was diagnosed, I didn't know whether to kind of say there because I didn't want to do a spoiler alert because that is quite shocking in the book, but there's so much more around that that I don't think it's too much of a spoiler. But yeah, like the immense stress that someone's carrying, and not only that, having to support all the financial support you have to provide because that person can no longer, you know, they can't work. And it's interesting, some of his behaviours that you mentioned earlier in the book, it kind of makes sense as well as to when he did get diagnosed. So in hindsight, for someone that's going through perhaps like that caring role or someone's going through that kind of really, really immense stress and carrying a lot, but they know that the alcohol's not actually helping them. And we know, like everyone knows that.
Yeah.
I think pretty much most people know now that alcohol increases your stress and your cortisol and all that kind of thing. You know it's not helping you, but fuck me, what are you going to do, you know?
Yeah.
We know, Julia and I know, that there is another way, and probably a lot of you guys listening, and maybe some of you don't. But, Julia, what would you say to someone that's going through something like that that wants a healthier way of learning how to deal?
I have thought about this a lot because I've thought, if I went back, what would I do differently now? And, you know, with the wisdom of hindsight, I mean, A, I wouldn't have been in that relationship. So I would have got out of there earlier. So I wouldn't have been in that situation to start off with. Even putting aside all of the other things, like even if he had been an angel, right, dealing with someone with early onset Alzheimer's, which changes people's personalities. So, you know, when people get Alzheimer's when they're older, they get a bit forgetful. They've still got access to their old memories, so it's fine. But with early onset Alzheimer's, like one of the very first times we went to the doctor and they do a mini memory state exam and they were asking John, you know, what day is it, what month is it, who's the prime minister, he could not remember how many siblings he had. Right. So the Alzheimer's was just taking chunks out of his memory that were seemingly random. So what he could remember just was all over the place.
So he could remember who the prime minister was and those kind of things.
Yep,
but then not, but not how many siblings had. Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also I had a teenage daughter at the time and I didn't have very much family support except from my dad and my stepmother. So my daughter ended up spending a lot of time with my dad, really to get away from the tenseness of the situation. And I felt incapable of parenting her at that point. Like, I just didn't have any bandwidth to do anything other than get through the day. So I think I probably would have really, I would have taken more care of myself. I thought that if I just pushed through, that was the only thing I could do and that was the best thing I could do. But actually, it didn't do me any favours. It didn't do my daughter any favours. And John, I'm not sure if anything would have made any difference to him in the end. But the impact of not taking care of myself was huge. So that's probably what I would do differently. And I would recommend anyone in that situation, I know, and it's really hard when you don't have space, but you need to find ways of taking care of yourself, getting out, taking time out, massages, yoga, going for walks by yourself, whatever it is. You have to fill your own cup. And I know that sounds cliched and whatever, but it just is true. Because if you flog yourself, you end up mentally and physically wrecked by the end of it.
Absolutely. And then also, if you're someone that's grown up with a core belief of feeling not very valued, feeling not worthy enough to be valued and cared for, it's also hard to then put those things into practice until eventually the body says no. If it manifests in addiction or some kind of autoimmune disease or some kind of disease in the body, it's going to show up eventually where the body says stop.
Yeah.
If you don't stop, I'm going to stop you.
Yeah.
And that's what happens, right? So tell me about when you got to the point of where you felt like, I need to quit, I've got to stop.
I got to that point. So after my husband went into care, my new partner also had a very public mental breakdown, which I won't go into that because that is probably a spoiler alert. So I had another, I think, a couple of years where I felt like I was just putting one foot in front of the other. And then I was at work. So I left Parliament and I got a job in health, and they have, you know, health things come around. And so they gave us a questionnaire and took our blood pressure and things like that. And one of the questionnaires was, how much do you drink? You know, or how many days a week do you drink? And I was like, well, 7, you know? And they said, your other risk factors here are quite low for, you know, you exercise, you do this, you do that, but probably be good if you cut down on your drinking a bit. And I thought, okay, it's time to start dealing with this. So that was 2017. So I started seeing a therapist at the beginning of 2018. I did, I think, a 1-month challenge and then a 3-month challenge. I can't remember quite what the order of it was. So I started having little stints of sobriety and feeling good in those, like not feeling like I was white knuckling in the same way. But I still felt scared about the prospect of doing it for longer. So I spent a couple of years, I think, or things would happen. So I signed up with the challenge with you, Danny. I think I was thinking back, I think it was the beginning of 2021. So I actually went through my mother's death sober. And then in the process after that, because of the very messy stuff that happened around her death and my step family, I started drinking again. So I came to the challenge and I got through, I think I got through 3 months, and then my husband almost died, and then I started drinking again. And then I actually got to a point at the beginning of 2022 when I lost a really close friend, and I just said, right, I'm going to give myself a year to stop trying to quit, which I know sounds really weird, but I was like, okay, let's just go this. Let's stop trying to do a month. Let's just see what happens. And I thought I might magically just stop being interested in drinking. And I was drinking less than I was at the peak when John was at home, and I was drinking probably a bottle and a half a night easily. So I wasn't drinking that much, but it just wasn't doing it for me. It wasn't making me feel physically good. It wasn't making me feel mentally good. And then I just got to December and I just went, you know what? I'm done. And then I thought, I need more help. And so I rejoined the challenge. And that was actually quite hard for me because I thought, oh God, what's Danny going to think? You know, like I didn't continue on with it and I'm coming back again. And you were just so welcoming. And I've still got the little note that you wrote saying, hey, Julia, looking forward to working with you again. I'm barracking for you. And I had that little post-it note on my computer for the whole year. And honestly, I didn't know if I was going to be able to get through a year. I just didn't know if I had it in me. I really didn't. And not because I thought of myself as an alcoholic, but I was just aware of how long I had been using alcohol to deal with stress. And that is my issue, dealing with stress with alcohol. And that has been the biggest gift of sobriety, is learning how to deal with stress without it. And it's not only okay, it's actually better. So what I find now is that I don't let myself get into the stress states I used to when I was drinking. So before I just go, I'm really stressed. I'm just going to push through this and I'm just going to get to the end of the day and have a glass of wine and that'll be fine. Whereas now if I feel myself get stressed and I know that I'm getting stressed because I'm more in touch with how I feel, I'm more in touch with the body sensations, I know how to sit with them, and I don't let myself get into the states that I used to. Yeah. And that's been an absolute game changer for me. Yeah, it's been absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing.
I'm doing happy dances here because also just as soon as you see, I feel what goes on in my body and you're starting to notice, you become more aware. And that's so important, Julia. I can't stress this enough, that the importance of doing a daily practice is not just so, oh, because I'm doing a daily practice. It's so that we become more aware of our bodies and our thoughts and our reactions so that we don't let ourselves get too out of our window of tolerance that we can't, we feel like we can't bring it back. And so that we want to start going, oh, I'm starting to come out a bit, or I'm starting to feel a little bit heightened. What do I, you know, my body's starting to flare up or show up and say, hey, something needs help here. We can respond and start to use our tools to bring us back. We don't always get it. Of course, sometimes we fly off and that happens, but the more we practice it, the better we get at it. And so that's so important. So it's about not letting yourself get so stressed in the first place that you end up reaching for something external, because sometimes we just, it's gone too far then at that point. Yeah, yes. It's just that. Thank you for saying that. It's a really, really important key in all of this, is learning. And I love also that you mentioned that you'd done the challenge once before and you felt a bit ashamed and that you came back. And that's really important too. I did a little solo cast a little while back on relapse. And I was just saying to people, whether it's you've worked with me before or you've worked with someone else, your person that's cheerleading you in sobriety wants you back. I can guarantee, unless they're a total fucking twat, and then they shouldn't be doing that job then anyway, but they want you back every time, even if it's like you come back 20 times, they want you back every time because that's what we're here for. I mean, we don't always get it every time, first time, and sometimes it just takes longer for some people to get used to using the tools, or just it takes a while sometimes for it to sink in. And also, it's not about just the tools. It's also about learning to value yourself enough so that you do feel that you are worthy of doing those practices for yourself, wouldn't you say?
Yep, absolutely. For me too, like it's been really important to accept that I did relapse, but I also learned from that. You know, it wasn't a disaster. It wasn't a terrible thing. It was something else that I learned from. And I think changing that perception, I don't think anybody who relapses should feel ashamed of it. It's like, you relapse. What did you learn from it? Why did you do that? Do some deeper work and find out why that happened. I think that's the important thing, like accepting all the parts of us, of ourselves, not just the good bits, not just the shiny bits, but all of it. Yep. That's been absolutely central for me in staying sober. And I'm one of those people, I don't say I'm going to be sober forever. I'm like, I'm sober because I want to be sober now. That's where I am. That's the thing that works best for my psychology.
Oh, my God. I love you. If I could jump through this Zoom and kiss you all over the face, I would. Yum. Oh. It's so good.
But But the thing that, like, the daily practices for me are absolutely essential. I'm quite rigid about them. So I absolutely do my stuff every day, no matter what. If for some reason I'm away, I do a version of it, and I'm really upfront with people now. So if I go away with people and I'll just say, I can't join you now because I've got to do my meditation, or I've got to do my yoga, or I've got to do my journaling. I'm just really upfront with people, and people are really curious. You know, they want to know, especially people who haven't seen me for a while. So I had a friend who was over from the US recently, and we went down to Albany and saw other friends that we haven't seen for a while, and they were just like, my God, what's happened to you? You know, because they just said, you look really good and really settled in yourself. And it was really nice. And I was just really upfront. I was like, this is what it takes. And for some people too, it might not be the right time for them. If you're having attempt after attempt and you're struggling, there's stuff that you need to work through, and yeah, maybe it's not your time yet, but you're still learning stuff.
Yes.
It's really important to be curious, I think. And I think you've taught us that, Danny, you know, be curious about your own experience and what's going on, and as accepting as you can be.
Absolutely. And you're so right. You're spot on 100% that there's no failure anytime ever. It's always just a learning opportunity, and always that, oh, I wonder what that was all about. Isn't that interesting? I just love that.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? Wonder why. What part of me was triggered then? What might that part have needed instead of the drink? Or I wonder why I felt like I couldn't cope with that then. How far back does that go? You know, there's so many questions we can ask. But yes, every situation that we're in that's super challenging is always an opportunity to do some deeper work, some healing. That's why they're just gifts, even sometimes when they don't feel like a gift when they're happening.
Sometimes they really don't.
What the fuck is this? I get it. Also, I just wanted to, in case I forget before we go on, so for people listening, Julia has also authored many, many books before this one. She's written a lot of books for teenagers. And there was one book that I thought, oh, this is interesting, mainly also because I've got a friend who's got a dad who's still around, and he's got early onset Alzheimer's. What is the name of so you wrote a book about that for kids experiencing that. What is the name of that book?
That's called Before You Forget.
Before You Forget.
Yeah. Beautiful. So that was published with Penguin in 2017. So that was me working through with my daughter. So because one of the things, she really struggled not having anyone understanding what she was going through. So we kind of wrote that together. I'd write something and ask what she remembered. So it's a version of what happened to her when she was in year 12.
Wow, what a gift for her. Have you ever heard Kelly Bruhaha, who's also one of the grads, amazing musician, have you heard her song called I'm Gonna Miss You?
No, I haven't.
Oh my God. I'll put it in the show notes, and I'm going to send it to you, Julia, after this. She wrote it for her dad as well, who's got early onset Alzheimer's, and it's all about how she's going to miss him when he's gone. Oh my God, I start tearing up. Just every time she plays it at a show, I just ugly cry my way through, like full on, like just bawling. Everyone in the audience bawls their eyes out. It's just such a beautiful song. And I'll send that. I'll send it to you. I would listen. I'm sure you'll appreciate that. So that's amazing, Julia. Can I just ask you, at the risk of sounding like a wanker, what was one of the sort of greatest takeaways do you feel from the challenge for people listening that perhaps are thinking about it?
For me, I think the sense of community was just amazing. I mean, I'm sure every grad group thinks theirs is really special, but I think our team was really special, and we're still in touch and supporting each other through everything that life throws at us. Because for me, knowing that I'm not alone in the struggles, it's just amazing. I can't overstate how amazing that is. It gives you strength when you don't think that you've got strength to go on, I think. And the tools that we learnt through it were absolutely life-changing for me. And, you know, I've been through a fuck ton of therapy, like I really have, but what I learned in the challenge is the stuff that I'll be using for the rest of my life. It's that valuable, and that it's the kind of stuff I'm like, oh God, I wish I'd known that earlier. You know, just not being afraid of how you feel. You know, just going, it's okay. You can feel uncomfortable and you can sit with it and it's okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just think it's an incredible set of tools. And I'm just so grateful to you, Danny, and Lyndall, and the whole setup that you have is amazing. It's just transformed so many lives, and I just think it's an incredibly, incredibly valuable thing.
Oh, thank you so much for saying that. It means a lot to me, obviously. And when you do one of the challenges to go on then and join the grads group, yes, we still talk about alcohol, but mostly, you know, we're meeting up every week. There's often morning calls where it's not really about sobriety so much anymore. It's about a continuing evolution of the self. So we might be talking, oh God, it could be anything we talk about on a Sunday night, or Lyndall might jump on and do a call and give exercises around certain things, or we do journaling prompts. So it's really about continuing to expand ourselves as we grow, that's what I'm kind of aiming to do for myself as well. And I hope as I learn things, passing them on, and we're learning together and continuing to grow together. It is a beautiful community. And yeah, I love this community so much. I love everyone in it. It's amazing. So speaking of, I have a new challenge coming up on May the 19th. And then the next one after that won't be until October. So for anyone interested, please do reach out or just jump onto the website and sign up. If anyone's interested in Julia's amazing book, jump on to my show notes. There'll be links there in which you can pre-order it or order it. Is it going to be on Audible as well, Julia?
I hope at some point. I don't know about that yet, but yes, I'm hoping it will be.
Amazing, because you're such a good speaker. It'd be great to have that opportunity. So speaking of the challenge and some of the work that you did, because you're a writer, I just have to take this opportunity. I know it wasn't written in so other people would be hearing it, but I asked you at the start of this if you would mind sharing your goodbye letter to alcohol, which we usually do at the end of each challenge, and if you would mind sharing yours.
Sure.
Again, this wasn't written for the public to hear, but I just, yeah, I'd love you to share it.
Okay. I probably won't read the whole lot because it is quite long, but I'll give you the highlights. Dear alcohol, I'm not going to just dump you without a word. We've been through so much together, and you and I both deserve to be clear about why, in spite of the good times, I don't need you anymore. You've been there all my life, for generations, actually. I wouldn't have been born without you. Hell, my parents met in a pub. You started as you meant to go on, inveigling your way into my life, so constant that nobody took much notice about you being there. But when I look back, so many of my formative memories involved you even before I got to know you myself. And let's not forget, I could see you were trouble. I saw the way you made adults angry, sad, loud, mired in misery. I saw the way you made them carry on as if there weren't children around, say things to children that should never be said. I hated the smell of you, especially on the skin of hungover adults in the mornings after parties. Remember when I used to tip you down the sink because I hated the way you made Mum feel and act? I didn't like you, and I didn't want you around, but nobody listened to what I wanted. So this letter is about you and me. The first time I remember you was on the long drive from Karratha to Perth when I was 5 years old. I'd laid down in the back of the Valiant, then vomited in between Nana's toes in her thongs. After using some of our precious drinking water to rinse her feet, she poured me a finger of brandy in a thermos cup. Here, she said, it'll make you feel better. And it did. The second time I remember you was in Broome, staying with my grandparents when I was 9. We were there, although I didn't know it, to try and save my parents' marriage. I swam in the ocean with my dad, learning to catch waves, but in the hot house, the tension made me uneasy. For the first time, I felt a thirst for alcohol. I asked for some beer. It was poured into the Vegemite glass I usually drank cordial from. I'd tasted it before, of course, but I had been repelled. This time the sour fizz made me feel elated. And then came my teenage years. Once my feelings became uncontrollable, you came into your own to help me out, or so I believed. When I was racked with longing for my first love, an obsessive pattern of attachment that repeated itself for years after, I didn't know what to do with my feelings. Oh, wait, what did adults normally do when life got too hard, too stressful, too uncomfortable? I want to get drunk, I announced, and Mum's friends were only too happy to oblige, pouring me glass after glass of summer wine. I remember talking to a friend on the phone and reporting that the wallpaper was sliding, righting itself, then sliding again. Mum's friends took turns walking me up and down the street as I did the phone box version of drunken dialing. The next day I was ashamed, but also relieved at letting my feelings out. At least now I didn't have to sit through Mum's parties while everyone else got drunk. I could join in. I could invite my friends. I could have conversations with adults who didn't let their feelings out either when they were sober. I began to be the one hosting the parties, and Mum would join in with my friends when she came back from the pub or a nightclub. Your mum is so cool, my friend said. There was danger in those parties, though. There was the obligatory vomiting, boys and girls weeping about the shit that was going on in their lives. Some of them ended up in jail or dead in car accidents not too long away, or they became parents too young. There were parties when the older neighbourhood boys came. There was sex which was not wanted and not resisted. I hitchhiked by myself at night in the Bogan suburbs. There were fights where the police were called and more when they weren't. My house didn't feel safe. It had rarely felt properly safe anyway, but now I was the one inviting in the people who didn't know when to leave, or the ones you wouldn't dare ask to leave. Some people tried to shame me into looking at your behaviour or express concern, even when I was 14 or 15, but I wasn't having a bar of it. I had so many dysfunctional behaviours that drinking seemed the least of it. So what if I threw a chair at my school friends in a club? So what if I started fights, made abusive phone calls, ended up sleeping with boys I didn't like, ended up sleeping on my girlfriend's doormat? Later, that girlfriend said, "It seemed like you didn't value yourself at all," and I was shocked. I'd never thought of it like that. I prided myself in being wild, in being angry, in pushing everything uncomfortable away. My life changed for the better once I was hospitalised for an eating disorder and I insisted that we move away from the Bogan suburbs. For a few months, Mum and I sat in our rat-infested house. The rent was cheap because the house was about to be demolished, and we drank beer together and listened to the Beatles. I always thought that you brought us closer together. We had a good time doing that until her current boyfriend, who was closer to my age than hers, took her attention. And then when I was 16, she told me she was moving in with another boyfriend, a beer-gutted man who lived in the Bogan suburbs we'd only just escaped. I refused to go, and so she moved without me, and I moved in with another ex-resident from the hospital, both of us 16. What could possibly go wrong? In the years of chaos that followed, I always had you there. I didn't have enough money to drink all the time, but it was reliable in a way that people weren't. I drank with our psychiatrist when he visited our flat, when I'd been stood up by my people, when I was sad and lonely, with street kids in the cross. I acted out under its influence, once trying to throw myself out of a moving car after a country party where I knew nobody and booze made me maudlin. When I got to uni at 19, I drank $1 middies of port at the social club, sat on my lecturers' laps and lectured them, much to my friends' amusement. I jumped through people's windows, shaved my head, continued making pissed declarations of love. My first encounter with recovery groups also happened through uni friends. I hung around serious political women who were sober in all respects of the word. I went to a recovery camp where everyone seemed miserable. I remember sitting in a meeting with someone listing her various addictions, and the person next to her said, "And you're a codependent." They were not my people, but they prompted me to do an adult child of alcoholics course, and I began my understanding of why I had taken up with you and the family dynamics that made you seem like a part of me. I'm not sorry for having had you in my life, because you've pointed me in the direction I now need to go. You've convinced me that I need to take myself and my self-care seriously. But what I really want to say to you is, alcohol, I don't need you anymore. In 12 days, it will be 12 whole months sober. Soon it'll be 500 days, actually. I love the clarity that I have, the quiet confidence that I now not only know what's good for me, but I know that I will do what's good for me. I have learned to take care of myself in the last year in new and deep ways. I have joined an orchestra and continued learning a new language because I can go out at night and still drive home and not spending the time I'm out craving for the relaxation of a glass of wine. I listen to my body, do yoga that nourishes me. I've been on a yoga retreat. I look around and appreciate what is in my life because I don't have you fucking with my cortisol. I can feel the anxiety that is still there, but I'm not afraid of it. I know I can feel any unpleasant or difficult emotion without you. I prioritize meditation so that I no longer let myself get stressed the way I used to, because there are no shortcuts, only constant, kind self-care. I wasn't sure I would be here a year on with four seasons of sobriety behind me, but I'm so glad I am and so proud of myself and grateful that I finally had the guts, the space to put the work in so that I am here now. I'm grateful for the support and knowledge I've gained from How I Quit Alcohol and this wonderful sober community. I worried that even if I made a year sober, I would want to let you back in now, but I have no reason to. There's nothing you could give me that I don't already have without you. I'm so grateful to be sober, and I'm so relieved to finally say goodbye to you, alcohol.
I got tears. Oh, Julia. Oh, it's so beautiful. I remember hearing that the first time, or a version of it, and just like, oh God, just amazing. I could just listen to you. I could listen to your words all day. It's just absolutely amazing. Thank you. Yeah, absolutely amazing. How does it feel to read that again?
It's really amazing. I feel very emotional and just so, so pleased that I had the courage to do this again. You know, like to do the challenge the second time and to keep going with it. I'm just, yeah, I don't take it for granted. I could have not, and I'm just grateful that I did.
Amazing, amazing. You are amazing. Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much. Thank you for coming on and sharing your story today. And, again, your book, How to Avoid a Happy Life, is out in just a couple of days, or for people that are listening post, out available through who, Julia?
Through Fremantle Press and through your local bookstore or your local library.
Amazing, fantastic. And, anyone wanting to reach out to Julia, I'll put all links to all things in the show notes. And, again, Julia, thank you so much for your time today. You're so wonderful. I'm so proud of you. And
thanks,
I loved the book. I must admit I had to Google a few of the words. How's that one where I said to you, I think this is a typo, there's a typo here. And you're like, no. You handled that with care. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I do. Well, see, because I've always written for kids, I've always had to be really careful and very clear with my language. So I just let myself go to town. This one's just like, you know, people, I mean, I've always enjoyed finding words, new words in books.
Oh, I love it. Ash has got the most incredible vocabulary. He's actually an English teacher. A lot of people don't know that about him. Although he hasn't.
No.
Yeah, he hasn't taught as an English teacher for like over 20 years now. But when we first met, that's what he was doing. He was a bit of music, but he was a school teacher. Anyway, and his vocabulary, though, I don't think that's to do with being a school teacher, but his vocab is absolutely phenomenal. And so I'd be reading the book at night. I'd be like, oh, Ash, what's this word? What does this word mean? And there was a couple there. He's like, oh, I don't know. So you even got him. But yay! I agree. I agree too. It's really nice. I love learning new words. I'm like, oh, yes, I'm going to put that one in a sentence at some point, yeah. But I usually forget it anyway. But no, it was just absolutely fabulous. It was such a journey to go on with you, and it was just such an insightful, incredible book. So I do recommend it for everyone listening to do, and just to support Julia. It's just great to support our local authors as well. So fantastic. Thank you.
And thanks, Danny.
See ya. Bye.
Bye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.